This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Everyone, welcome to another edition of the most frequently interrupted podcast in all of Place to Be Nation, the Hard Traveling Fanboys. I am Greg Phillips. With me, as always, is my partner in crime, the modern day Maharaja, Nick Duke. Nick, how are you?
I'm doing very well, sir. Actually, I was gonna tell you I'm doing quite well because I've been talking to my contacts, my sources inside the comic book podcasting industry, Greg. And I have come across. I'm privy to some information. It sounds as if we're starting to really generate some award buzz, Greg. I have been told by multiple sources that there's a chance, there's a possibility that we have the potential. Not saying it's going to happen, but we have the potential to maybe bring home some halfies this year, from what I've been told.
I haven't heard this, Nick. I mean, are these reliable sources?
My sources have never led me wrong.
Wow, we are up for halfie consideration.
That's what I've been told. Now, I don't know what category. I don't know. If it's individual awards, if it's mostly just for me, which is what I would assume, or if it's more for the collective effort, I'm really not sure. But I've been told that there's some buzz out there.
You know, that's really interesting, Nick, because I was under the impression that we were blackballed from all award shows after your noted anti-archism and anti-jaretism came to the forefront recently.
Anti-archism, you've been throwing around these baseless accusations for the better part of a year now, and they're not true. And anti-jaretism, Greg, I don't even think the audience knows what the hell you're talking about, which isn't really unusual for your sorry ass.
Well, quite frankly, anti-jaretism, for those who may not know, is defined by Webster's as a clinical opposition to all things related to professional wrestler Jeff Jarrett. How do you answer these charges?
I answer them that they're not true. I mean, how many times have I praised Jeff Jarrett's TNA Pyro, for example? These things just aren't true.
Oh, we just made the list once again.
That's right. Do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do.
Hose A and Hose B.
That's actually pretty good. Okay, you got me with that one.
Yep. So the halfies, for those that don't know, they're just around the corner here, coming up here in June, the most prestigious night in our industry. We have a litany of guests lined up here for this show where we give out the awards at the halfway point of the year. And what I understand is the format is a little bit different this year, where the criteria for the awards is a little bit different. But rest assured, all the stars will be here. We have lined up to be a guest, a former president. We have a famous internationally renowned actor. We have a legendary wrestling commentator. We have
two legendary wrestling commentators.
Oh, that's true. That's true. And we have a legendary wrestling writer who briefly appears. So
that's right.
I mean, we've got.
And if he can get away from the set of Crocodile Dundee 5, from what I have been told, Greg, Hogan might be there.
That's right. Paul Hogan might be at the Haffy Awards. So. Stay tuned to your Place to Be Nation pop feed, which you can find on iTunes, on a variety of streaming services, however you get your podcasts, Podbean, or through our website, placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. Stay tuned to the feed because those Halfie Awards will be coming up just around the pike here in the next month or so. But tonight...
Yeah, I believe that they're currently slated for the last week of June. So we got a little while, but you know, they come at the end of June. And you may be asking yourself, well, what are you going to do for the in the weeks that, that are between now and then? Well, quite frankly, we're celebrating all things Wonder Woman as we bring to you tonight the first installment in Wonder Woman Month.
That's right. Patty Jenkins' Wonder Woman film is hitting theaters this weekend and getting the early critical buzz is tremendous for this film. And we thought, what better way to celebrate DC's preeminent female superhero than with an entire month dedicated to all things Wonder Woman. And we're going to kick things off tonight with one of the more talked about stories or runs in the storied history of Wonder Woman, a character that dates all the way back to the 1940s. We are here to talk about the 2011 New 52 reboot of Wonder Woman by the creative team of Brian Azzarello and Cliff Chang. This came after, of course, the Flashpoint event that kind of reset DC continuity in 2011 and set the stage for the New 52. And the New 52, of course, was had its ups, had its downs, but one of the more consistent ups was this Brian Azzarello and Cliff Chang run on Wonder Woman. Very talked about at the time, very consistently well-reviewed, and very near and dear to a lot of people's hearts over the course of an initiative, a publishing initiative that many would say was ultimately a long-term a failure. So coming right out of the gates, both you and I have a lot of similarities in our approach to Wonder Woman, Nick, in that while I grew up reading DC Comics, I didn't really read solo Wonder Woman comics at all as a child.
Nor did I.
And I didn't really start reading Wonder Woman until recently with the Rebirth Initiative. And I've read some here and there in the past, like standalone issues during Greg Rucka's initial Wonder Woman run, maybe a few Gail Simone issues here or there. But by and large, my only exposure in comics to Wonder Woman was through Justice League, both the cartoon and the comic, and through her appearances in other comics like Batman, Superman, etc. What about you, Nick? What has been your primary exposure to the character of Wonder Woman?
Yeah, much like you just said, I think, you know, honestly, I had never really been a big time Justice League reader until Jeff Johns' Justice League run during the New 52. So I kind of came to it at that point, and that's predominantly my exposure to Wonder Woman. Prior to that, of course, I had read her in you know, some stories that I had reached back to, like Infinite Crisis and various other things from the 90s and 2000s that I kind of had you know, taken a retroactive look at. But in terms of solo Wonder Woman comics, I'd never read any. I think I may have picked up a couple. I think there was a Blackest Night tie-in of some sort that I checked out that involved Wonder Woman. But other than that, man, not really a whole lot. The thing that got me excited was, you know, when Rebirth started and they announced that Greg Rucka was coming back to DC, that sold me. And then when the concept art started coming out, the first pages of Liam Sharp art, and of course the Nicola Scott art, it was a book I jumped on with the Rebirth Initiative and have never been disappointed in that decision since. So most of my Wonder Woman comic knowledge is going to come from the last year or so. But, you know, being a comics fan, I, of course, heard about this Brian Azzarello and Cliff Chang run, and it was something I was always interested in checking out and had the opportunity to do so recently.
Yes, and I also assume you watched the Justice League cartoon as well, so you got...
Oh, yeah, of course. However, I have never seen the Wonder Woman direct-to-DVD animated movie that everybody says is great.
Yes, it's very, very good. But needless to say, we don't come into this story as Wonder Woman experts. This is actually the rare case of the Long Book Hunters where we are reviewing a book that neither of us had read prior to reading it for this show. So we're both coming into it with a set of fresh eyes. And disclaimer, we're also coming into this after reading a year straight of the Greg Rucka, Liam Sharp, and Nicola Scott Wonder Woman, which kind of has colored our thoughts on the character, I think. And And for me, also a little bit of the late 80s, early 90s kind of era of Wonder Woman. One of the interesting things about this is a kind of a hard reset for Diana. This is an approach to Diana that is a little bit different from what we had seen before. Obviously, Greek mythology has always been, to my understanding, a big part of Wonder Woman's past, especially with George Perez's run in the 80s, which really kind of added to that mythology and made these god characters a big part of the title. But Azzarello kind of takes that up a notch and really focuses on Diana as a mythological character and a cast of mythological characters that at times reminds me a little bit of the book that we reviewed last year called The Wicked and the Divine. We get a lot of very distinctly drawn, unique-looking gods, and it is clear that Diana exists in her own corner of the DC universe, kind of apart from everything else, even though we do see her in Justice League regularly. Do you think that's a fair kind of setting of the table for this story?
Yeah, I mean, you drew the comparison to The Wicked and the Divine. The comparison I drew as a longtime Thor fan was kind of more to, you know, some of the Thor comics that lean very heavily into the Asgard-based stuff, into the Norse mythological aspect of it. You know, pulling deep into the mythology for characters like, you know, the Warriors 3 or Baldur or Freya or Freya or Hela or any of the numerous Asgardian Norse mythological characters that the Thor run has used throughout time. And this kind of feels the same way in this volume because we get characters like Hermes, get characters like Poseidon, Ares, Apollo, Hades, all making appearances. And of course, you know, actually, come to think of it, I think he only makes an appearance via flashback, but Zeus is very much present in the story being talked about. But I don't remember,
yeah.
Greg, correct me, you've read it since I have. He doesn't play an active role in the story, but he set everything into motion. Everything revolves around his action.
In fact, the everybody talks about him like he's dead. Nobody knows. He basically has vanished, and nobody knows where he is. Kind of like the beginning of Preacher, when God abdicates his throne. Zeus is gone, and everybody presumes him dead. And that is kind of what sets the story in motion here. But we do see him in flashbacks due to a pretty big reveal that takes place in the second issue, I believe, of this story that we'll get to in just a minute. But one of the interesting things about the mythological creatures here that reminded me of Wicked and the Divine is the very humanistic appearance or traits of these gods, which is very in keeping with the actual mythology, because even though they are gods,
well, we see except them, for Poseidon, who is his entire – he's his own separate entity unto himself. As drawn in this book anyway.
Right. Oh, yes. I'm not even referring to the appearances necessarily, but somewhat the appearances as well, because you certainly see humanoid figures as all these gods, except for Poseidon and except for arguably for Hades, who has a very unusual appearance that we'll talk about later on. But yeah, you're right about that. Poseidon has a very different look. But they also all have these very human desires and human vices, if you will. You know, we see Apollo, and he is womanizing and enjoying alcohol. We see pretty much an alcoholic take on strife. We see we see the jealous Hera. We see the brave Hermes. We see all of these kind of human traits embodied by gods, and that's very in keeping with the actual Greek mythology, which I appreciated. But what this book does is kind of early on gives a pretty major change to Diana's origin. For those that are familiar with the quote modern age Wonder Woman, most of us know the origin story that she was formed from clay. Her mother, Hippolyta, could not have a child, formed the child out of clay, prayed to the gods for a miracle, and Diana was born, and that's kind of what was set out as the story. Well, what Azzarello and Chang do is very early on, they kind of turn that on its head, and it's revealed that Hippolyta lied about Diana's true origins for all these years, because the true origin of Diana is that she is one of Zeus's many, 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 many bastard children, which if anybody knows anything about Greek mythology, that is one of Zeus's number one characteristics, is he gets around. He gets around more than Tammy Sitch in the WWF locker room.
Oh, Greg. Greg with shots fired here. We don't need that drama in our life, Greg, because don't put it past certain individuals who you may or may not have just mentioned to start Twitter feuds with relatively irrelevant comic book podcasts.
Hey, you know what they say, Nick? Controversy creates cash.
That's a good point.
However,
it's strange hearing that coming from you, given the fact that you run from controversy so often on these very airwaves.
However, controversy also leads to lawsuits down the line. So, but certainly Zeus gets around and has had a ton of bastard children, including but not limited to the likes of Strife and this character we meet later on in the story that we'll get to as well, called Lennox. And it turns out that Diana is the result of a love affair between Queen Hippolyta of the Amazons and Zeus many years ago. And as a result of this affair, Diana is born, but knowing how jealous Hera is of Zeus's children by other women, in order to protect Diana, Hippolyta makes up the clay story and keeps it from everyone, doesn't tell a soul about it except for her closest advisor, and everybody else believes the story of Diana being made from clay. Well, in this story, we find out at the same time that Diana finds out about her true origins, and it really turns the entire thing on its head. What did you think about this twist on Diana's origin?
You know, I obviously knew the twist coming in. It was one of the things that was talked about whenever people built it up to me, whether it be online or in person, was how heavily it was tied in to the Greek mythology. And so I knew that that was kind of the theme of it, was that it was kind of about Diana finding her place in this new, you know, her new place in the world, now that she knows she does have the blood of the Greek pantheon within her. So I knew about it coming in, but I kind of liked it. I like the idea that Hippolyta had to keep this secret from her and did it for, you know, reasons that are somewhat revealed here, but I'm sure there's a little bit more into it that goes into it if we wind up reading more of the run and whatnot. But yeah, I really enjoyed it. To be honest, while I don't hate the made from clay origin, it's always been one of the aspects of Wonder Woman that was tough to wrap my head around. I know it's comics. You got to accept a certain, you know, suspend your disbelief and accept certain things. But I don't know. The made from clay thing just always kind of bugged me. And I kind of like this daughter of Zeus origin a little bit better, if I'm being honest.
Yeah, it's one of those things where, like, I thought that I would dislike it more than I did, because I've always kind of liked the made from clay origin because it's different. It's unique. But like you said, the more that I started thinking about it, the more I really, really liked this twist. And the way it was actually done is even better than we're describing it here, in my opinion. I thought the issue in which the truth is revealed is the best issue in this collection, in my opinion. By the way, the book that we're reviewing, I guess I should mention, is Wonder Woman Volume 1 Blood, which you can purchase most likely at your local comic book shop. You can certainly get it on Amazon. Or rather your local bookstore. It's only $14.99, so not a bad cover price for a trade collection with six issues in it. So, nevertheless, all that aside, this is I thought this was the strongest issue. This issue we're referring to, that the truth is revealed, and the sequence of pages in which Hippolyta explains her tryst with Zeus, I think, is some of Cliff Chang's strongest artwork, and I think that it's probably one of the most emotionally affecting scenes, because Diana, just as you can imagine, now believes that her entire life is a lie. She believes that, you know, everything that she's ever believed about herself is wrong, and Hippolyta only revealed the truth to her because Strife was about to do it, And so Hippolyta beat her to the punch, essentially. Really powerful stuff here. And because of that execution, Nick, I think that made this work for me really well, to the point where, honestly, I can accept either origin at this point. And I like that idea of Diana herself not really knowing what her real origin is, you know? I think that's something that actually carried through into the Rebirth version, is Diana being deceived in some way about her true origins and her true nature.
Yeah, do we even know at this point what her true origin is?
No, we do not. Not in the Rebirth run.
Because in this volume here, where it's revealed to her that she is a daughter of Zeus, it happens on Themyscira. But according to Rebirth, this Themyscira from this volume is a fake Themyscira that's not real. So does anything that takes place upon this Themyscira have any bearing in the current continuity?
I don't know. Quite frankly, Nick, it's not for us to say.
It's not for us to say. I'd suggest you just, you know, go along for the ride and try to enjoy yourself, quite frankly.
We do get introduced to a lot of characters in this book.
Oh, Jim Ross has to play Basil Exposition in the Austin Powers inevitable reboot.
Good news, Austin. Or maybe it's bad news. Hell, what are you asking me for? It really is not for me to say, Austin, for God's sake. It turns out Vanessa...
Evil in Austin!
It turns out Vanessa was a fembot. Yeah, we knew all along, quite frankly.
What is shit?
Actually, if you go back and you read Poseidon's dialogue in this book, read it in JR voice. I think you'll like what you find.
Oh, God. I'll have to do that at some point.
But yeah, we get introduced to a lot of characters in this that are new to me, whether they be the god characters or not. We meet very early on Hermes, who's one of the companions of Diana in this book. This new character named Zola, who is actually carrying, stop me if you've heard this before, another bastard child of Zeus. And we meet Apollo, who...
Greg, did you know that Zeus sired a baseball team? An orchestra, if you count the bastards.
I've heard that. I've also heard that if you drop a phonograph needle on Zeus's nipple, it plays the Beach Boys' Pet Sounds. Now, the question is, Nick, what would happen if Zeus ever met the High Evolutionary?
Oh, then we'd have quite the... We'd find ourselves in quite the pickle now, wouldn't we?
We would.
We wouldn't know that. Down would be up would be down. Cats and dogs living together. Mass hysteria.
Absolutely. We meet Apollo, who looks a little bit like Tombstone from Spider-Man, but with glowing eyes. We meet Hera, who walks around naked. We meet, just a litany of characters here. We meet later on, we meet Hades and Poseidon, a new character named Lennox. We meet all of the Amazons, including one in particular who was a real bitch. Quite frankly, the redheaded one that I'm trying to remember the name of, she challenges Diana to a sparring match, loses, and then seems to be so bitter about it that she holds it against Diana the rest of the time.
I think there's some misplaced sexual aggression going on in that relationship.
Aleka is her name, and she gets knocked out by Diana in a very satisfying moment. But yeah, so we meet a bunch of these characters, and the basic premise is Diana is trying to protect this woman who is the Zola woman from the wrath of Hera, only to later find out that she herself is subject to the wrath of Hera because Hera finds out that Diana is one of Zeus's bastard children. And that, I think, is another strong point of this comic, is that entire issue where Hera goes to confront Hippolyta.
Hippolyta, yeah, that's a good issue. I'll agree with that.
And basically wipes out the Amazon, seemingly. Is that, yeah. not a good turn of events for Diana, who returns...
Turns Hippolyta to stone.
And turns all the Amazons into snakes.
Yep.
And Diana, you know, they say hell hath no fury like a woman scorned, and certainly you see that in this volume. Diana has a very heartbreaking moment where she goes back to see her mother one last time, finds her turned to stone, and has a tearful apology where she realizes that, you know, it's that classic story of the child that leaves home and maybe says some things they don't mean, and they come back and it's too late to apologize. So, yeah, great, great moment here.
Absolutely agree. Yeah, all the stuff that happened on Themyscira really was really good. It's certainly a different take on Themyscira than you know I am more familiar with the Greg Rucka Rebirth run, but it's one that really works for me. I would say the Themyscira aspects and every time they chose to introduce a new Greek god were some stuff I really enjoyed. I know late in the book when they introduce Poseidon, when they introduce Hades, the scene in a bar where they give us their version of Ares. All the mythology based stuff they were doing here.
Ares as a withered old man is a very, very cool take, who seems to be on his last legs but knows something that maybe we don't know and maybe that Apollo doesn't know, which is that war doesn't stay down for too long and eventually that he would have the power again. It's a big, big political power struggle going on because we mentioned at the beginning of the show that Zeus is gone right now. Well, Zeus's absence has created this power vacuum, and everybody is trying to go for it. Hera is going for it. Apollo is going for it. Hades and Poseidon are going for it. And whoever wins this power struggle dominoes are going to fall from there. And that's going on in the background of Diana trying to protect Zola and her baby, and also Diana trying to cope with this new knowledge that she has, and probably, even though she never outright states it, the kind of unspoken subtext is that she wants revenge on Hera for what she's done to her mom. So, there's a lot going on here.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. If I'm being honest, it was a little bit overwhelming at first, just because unlike a lot of the new 52 books that kind of sought to reestablish your understanding of the character and kind of almost tell a new origin story in many cases, this one kind of drops you in right there and expects you to just catch up at a certain point. There's very little handholding going on when it comes to these characters and concepts. And so it took a little while to adjust to it, but you're right, Greg. This is really a dense, jam-packed read.
Right. It's, you know, some of the complaints, I suppose, about the early, particularly the early Greg Rucka Wonder Woman issues that I heard from people is that it was too slow moving for them. Well, if that's the case, this is the run for you because this one is rapid fire. I mean, stuff is happening constantly. And like you said, I liked it and I enjoy the rise. I really dug this take on the character, but man, it is a lot to keep up with, like you said. There were moments, honestly, when I was a little lost and had to kind of backtrack to try to figure out, you know, what was going on and why characters were behaving a certain way.
Yeah, I think the first few pages of the book, it features Hermes in a major action scene, and I'm like, who is this character and why should I care about him and why is Diana coming to his aid? Like, I didn't understand much of anything that was going on, but the book, you know, the more you read, the more you start to pick up and you have to kind of look back at those early pages with a different set of context, I suppose.
Particularly strange was the scene before we find out Diana's true origins when Hermes walks to her and says, "Who is your daddy and what does he do?"
Oh, I like it.
It was very, very unusual. But no, it was, a lot of things happening here. And again, I enjoyed it. It was super entertaining. But it's hard to escape that once or twice. It doesn't happen constantly. There's once or twice in the book that you have to kind of stop it and be like, wait a minute. Whoa, what's going on here? Like, why are these characters here and why are they behaving in such a manner?
There's no hand-holding going on in this one.
Now, one thing that's interesting that I wanted to talk to you about, because this is an aspect that I think we kind of disagree on, the artwork by Cliff Chang. I am a huge fan of this artwork. Like, it really blew me away. I think to the point where as good as the writing was and as interesting as the characters were, I think the art was probably my favorite part of this book up to a certain point that I'll explain in a minute. I really like the smoothness of the lines. I really like the expressiveness of the characters. The way that Cliff Chang draws, certainly the way he draws women, but just the way he draws everyone in this book is very distinctive and interesting. And his storytelling is really good, too, in his pages in this book. Unfortunately, there is a rather jarring artistic change towards the end with Tony Akins, who does his best to keep that Cliff Chang style. But to me, the Akins pages were a noticeable drop-off, and there are some really confusing story moments in the last issue in particular that kind of threw me off. The whole like climax sequence near the end was not really effective for me because of the art. Nick, what did you think of the art in this one? I think that you're a little bit softer on it than I am.
Yeah, I suppose overall I liked it, but it kind of... It didn't really blow me away the way it did you. I mean, it's serviceable, in my opinion. But then again, that comes from, like, again, my perception has been colored, and I've been reading Wonder Woman for the last year with either Nicola Scott, Pequise Evely, or Liam Sharp, who, in my opinion, is one of the best artists going in comics today. So it's just been a year of outstanding Wonder Woman art, and I kind of feel like, just my opinion, the art in this first volume doesn't, for me anyway, measure up to what I've seen over the last year.
Yeah, and for me, it's just different.
Right. Yeah, I mean, absolutely different. I'm just saying, you know, you have your preferences.
Yeah, there are things about this that I like better, I think, and there are things about it that maybe I like better on the current run artistically. But both phenomenal in my view. But I did think it dropped off in those last two issues with the Tony. No knock on Tony Akins, really. He's certainly a capable artist, but it's the story didn't flow as well when he was writing it. What's the term I'm looking for? It didn't flow like a Wonder Woman story is supposed to flow. Yeah. And there's one that about...
You better watch out, Greg. There might be eyes and ears throughout the place.
He has eyes and ears in all podcasts, just in case he gets referenced. So perhaps a certain individual might be listening to stooge us off to him.
Are you suggesting that we may have listeners who wear giant penis costumes?
Well, actually, yes, but probably for different reasons.
Not that there's anything wrong with that. Anybody out there who may or may not wear giant penis costumes in your spare time.
There's nothing wrong with a giant penis costume once in a while. Once in a while. Let me talk, Nick, about kind of an elephant in the room in this comic. We've talked about how awesome Poseidon is awesome in this. Poseidon is like a giant...
frog thing.
Frog, fish, squid hybrid thing, and he's awesome. And his first appearance, yes. He says, "Ma, you are an Amazon? Huh. There's more to you. Zeus." Well, his blood no longer holds.
Now, is it
water?
Now, wait a minute, Greg. Is it Zeus or is it Zeus?
That's a totally different Zeus. We don't see him, unfortunately. That's how they should have drawn Zeus in this.
That's
book.
That's the twist, is that Tiny Lister pops up at some point.
Poseidon is awesome, though. He's just the most over the top Thor like thing that you'll find in this whole thing. Just very.
He's awesome. Very, he was my favorite Greek god in this book. If I'm being honest.
Yeah, and again, these are Greek gods that are largely humanoid in nature until you see Poseidon. You also get a glimpse of Hades, which is part of the big cliffhanger at the end here. Hades is drawn like a normal person wearing armor, except he seems to have melting candles over his head.
Certainly a unique situation.
Which leads me to the one character that I thought did not work in this book. And that is this new character. I don't know if he's a new character or not. He's new to me. Of Lennox.
Yeah.
Who, the best way I can describe him is, and this is honestly how I read him, and to the point where I thought he was this character for about the first two or three pages he was on. And that's this character of Linux, because I thought he was John Constantine. And the best way I could describe him would be a Kmart version of John Constantine. He's a British guy with blonde hair who smokes and wears a long trench coat and is kind of dismissive to everyone he talks to. Sounds a lot like John Constantine, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I would agree with that. And I didn't know who. That's one thing I want to know. If you have the answer out there, was, you know, feel free to tell us, you know, our listeners, was Linux a pre-existing character, or was he just pop up in the story as a new character and start bossing people around?
Yeah, I didn't.
And the answer to that, Greg, apparently I just Googled it. Apparently his first appearance was in Wonder Woman Volume 4, Number 5 in March of 2012.
Yeah, it's very strange. Everyone just talks to him and listens to him and has him in on this big plan to one-up Hera, and there's really no reason for them to trust him or know what his deal is, you know? Maybe a better move would have been to have Diana put her lasso around him to see what his deal is, but very bizarre. That character is the one aspect of this story that didn't work for me. By and large, I loved it. I thought all of the stuff with the political power play on Olympus was phenomenal. The characterizations of the Greek gods were awesome. Diana's great. Kind of going through a personal struggle here. I have maybe a few small complaints, and Linux is one of them. What did you think about the Linux character?
Yeah, much like you, I was just kind of confused as to why everyone was automatically listening to him, or really what his stake in everything was. I didn't understand what his motivation was and what he was seeking to accomplish, or what kind of personal gain was in it for him. It just felt like he just randomly popped up out of nowhere, and everybody just kind of went with it. It was one of the aspects of the story, one of the only aspects of the story that I felt like, you know, wasn't explained very well. And his presence was never really justified in any, like, I don't really see why he was integral to the story they were telling. But again, it's the first installment of a long run, so perhaps, you know, there's later stuff that Azarello is setting up. I really can't, you know, quite frankly, it's not for me to say.
Yeah, well, the implication is that he is another one of Zeus's children. And
right.
He discovered that.
But those are a dime a dozen, Greg. There's like 150 of those out
there. That's true. Or more, yeah. There's a ton of them, no doubt. There's a great line in this book, by the way, when they're talking about the different forms that Zeus assumes to seduce women. Hermes asks Zola, what form did Zeus take on to seduce you, and her answer is a truck driver.
He was a truck driver, or he might have been,
or he might have been a pool
hustler,
been a
guitar player,
or he might have been in a band. Yeah. I hope he was in a band. And then
she's like, "What? I like sex."
Yeah, I like sex. Really great exchange here. That was another thing I wanted to point out about this book that I really like. The dialogue is great.
Yeah, it is.
It's very contemporary, very modern. Never comes off hokey.
And the character of Zola, that little exchange that we just talked about, just an example of how she comes off as, you know, not, she is not a damsel in distress. She is not someone who is, you know, perfect in her purity. Like, she's a flawed human. And I mean, that's kind of the appeal of having a character like that in a story about gods, is a human who is as inherently flawed as any human you'll encounter. So I liked her inclusion, even though I was lukewarm on her at first. She kind of grew on me as the book went on.
Yes, I definitely agree. She's that flawed character that's thrown in here among gods. One other minor complaint I would have is that at times it feels like it's not Diana's story, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I can certainly see that.
And so that's a very minor complaint that I have, because overall it really worked for me. But there are times when it feels like it's maybe Zola's story, or even Hippolyta's, more than it is Diana's. But that being said, the Diana stuff in here is really good, including the action near the end when she's fighting Poseidon briefly, although she knows she can't beat him heads up. So she's kind of outsmarting all these god characters near the end. So yeah, a lot of good stuff throughout with regards to the dialogue. I was trying to find some of the other standout scenes here, but yeah, the dialogue's great. The artwork, mostly very good. And it ends with a pretty fascinating cliffhanger. You talked about how Zola grows on us as the book progresses. I certainly agree with that. And she kind of ends the book. The book ends by placing her in a level of peril. And certainly that's a good way to end it, because we were invested enough in her, at least I was invested enough in Zola, that I care about what happens to her next. And since she's not around in the current run, there's genuine intrigue on my part about what becomes of her character going forward. What did you make of the cliffhanger here?
Yeah, I liked it as well. Did a good job of building that character over the course of the story. And then just as you're starting to warm to her and grow intrigued by her, it injects some mortal peril in there. And I think that's a smart thing to do, and certainly helps to get new readers like you and I interested, and help us, maybe hook us into continuing on to another volume.
Do you think that it would be possible at some point, Nick, to get an audio version of this book narrated by Mike Tyson, just so we can hear him say, "Lennox!" repeatedly?
Lennox, the surefire massive success that will be Place to Be Nation Pop Comic Book Theater takes off later this year, there's really no telling where we can go or what we can do in terms of celebrity voice interpretations of popular comic book stories.
I think that having Mr. Tyson do the voice of Lennox would be really good, because when people refer to him as Lennox, for instance, there's this exchange in the catacombs where Hades says, you interest me, Mr. Lennox, and he responds, and perhaps Tyson could say this with the affectations, of course, as just Lennox, Lord Hades, leave the mister for me, sister. So that could be really effective. So we don't want to give away all the details of the story, this, that, and the other, except to give you the basic outline of the plot and tell you, that what we thought about the writing. We've been over the art. Talk a little bit about Brian Azzarello. How does he work as a fit for Wonder Woman, in your opinion? He's mainly known for doing his kind of gritty crime-based stories. 100 Bullets, Batman, things like that. Pardon me. How did you feel that he would be a fit for Wonder Woman, and how did it work in execution, in your opinion?
Well, I never really gave it much thought when it was happening. I always knew that I liked Brian Azzarello's work in the past, and I never really paused to consider his fit on Wonder Woman because I didn't know much about Wonder Woman as a character. I will say, after reading this, if we're talking specifically about his ability to write the character of Wonder Woman, I will say that I liked what I saw here, but there wasn't quite enough of it, just because of what you mentioned, where there's long stretches of the story where it doesn't really feel as if Diana is the central focus. But that being said, I thought he fleshed out the world and wrote the supporting characters and set a tone for the book extremely well. So I'm a little... I want to see more of his Diana before I can speak definitively on that particular characterization, but the rest of it, like I said, really, really works.
Something I'm interested in from your perspective, Nick, you've read all the major Thor runs, I believe, going back to the 60s.
Yes.
Where would you compare this, if you had to compare this to a tone and a style of a Thor run, who would it most compare to, or what run would it most compare to Thor-wise?
Oh man, that's a great question. It's interesting because the take that Azzarello has is that they are very much Greek gods, but they almost conduct themselves in a very contemporary manner. They have very human interactions. They indulge in vices and drink at bars and have arguments and all this kind of stuff without having this grandiose over the top aspect to it that often pervades some of the Thor comics. So I guess, and this may not be a great comparison, but the one that I would most immediately remind me of would probably be the J. Michael Straczynski run, just because of how much it focuses on the ideas of gods come to Earth and interacting with the larger populace around them, rather than just being confined to their own little corner of the universe on Mount Olympus or what have you. So it's a, I think that's the one I would go with.
Gotcha. Now, looking back at this book as a whole, I would definitely recommend people to give this a try. It's different if you're.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
If you're used like we are to the Greg Rucka and Nicola Scott and Liam Sharp run, it's different, very very different. I would say that the current run is probably more traditional. This one is the one that we're reviewing here today is a more violent kind of almost grittier kind of take on Wonder Woman than you might be used to. There's a lot of blood in this. There's a lot of sex in this kind of. And so it's a different kind of take on the mythos. But I would say give it a shot, because if you are the kind of person that is open to different interpretations of these characters, and I think Diana is certainly a character that is open to multiple interpretations. You know, we talked a couple podcasts ago, Nick, about how Green Arrow is a character who is maybe more so than anyone open to multiple different valid interpretations. I think Diana is up there too in that regard. So if you're open to that, give this a shot. If you have a more traditionalist mindset and have one kind of vision of Diana, I don't know that this would be the book for you.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. You're right. It is very different, especially from the current Rebirth run. So I can get behind that.
And if you're somebody that hasn't read the new Rebirth run, or if it didn't work for you for whatever reason, if you're just you've never thought yourself to be a fan of the Wonder Woman character, maybe you're into the more gritty side of comics, maybe some of the Marvel street level comics, stuff like that, Thor, things like that. Maybe you give this a shot, because this is a very different take and a very cool take that I think most people will be able to enjoy this because of the artwork and because it is a very visceral kind of look at a character that you wouldn't necessarily expect that from. So I would say give this a shot. What about you, Nick?
Oh, I absolutely say give it a shot. Yeah, I mean, at the very least, you'll open yourself up to a different take on Wonder Woman, and it's one that I find worthwhile, much like you do. So I'm certainly interested in continuing this run and seeing where it goes from here. I don't know that I would say go out and buy the first volume immediately. It's not that emphatic of a recommendation, but I definitely encourage anybody who has an opportunity to check it out. You know, I know some people in our Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook group and some of the other groups that we participate in on Facebook, Greg, have access to services like Hoopla Digital through their local library. So if this is on there, give it a look.
Definitely a good idea. And I'm interested to see what happens in volume two at some point. So definitely looking forward to seeing where that goes. And I think this is another kind of tying back to the beginning of the episode, Nick. This is another example of some of the good stuff in the New 52 that doesn't really get talked about a lot.
Yeah, well, this was one of the few things from the New 52, the Azzarello Wonder Woman run, that kind of got pretty universal praise as it was going on. It was critically beloved during the New 52. So this is one of those, you know, aspects that's kind of always been, I think it has been talked about a pretty fair amount, but it's one that slipped under my radar just because of my lack of knowledge of Wonder Woman at the time. And it's one that, after checking it out, I can see why it worked for people.
So there you have it, folks. That wraps up our review of Wonder Woman Volume 1, Blood. You can find this, like I said, at pretty much any local comic shop. I've seen it stocked at most of the ones that I've been to recently. So check it out. Give it a read. With all that being said, give us your thoughts on this story. Where does this rank in your favorite Wonder Woman runs? What is your vision of the Wonder Woman character? Do you think that there are multiple valid takes? Or are you more of a traditionalist? Or do you just prefer this Azzarello and Chang run? Tell us what we got right. Tell us what we got wrong. Do that on Twitter. I am at gphillips8652. Don't worry, I'm working. I'm considering changing that at some point to make it something less convoluted. He is at NickDuke87. Or you can join us on the Facebook Place to Be Nation comics page. Just type in Place to Be Nation Comics. We should be the first thing that comes up. Join the group and join the discussion. We have a lot of good discussion there, a lot of great members of that group. And you can also send us emails, GregP@PlaceToBeNation.com, NickD@PlaceToBeNation.com. Please send us some emails, because right now it's almost exclusively spam.
Yeah, it was very interesting. You know, we are in the planning process, Greg, for getting the halfies together, as we mentioned earlier. And so I have several emails in my Place to Be Nation inbox right now with halfies in the subject line. And then I have a couple for Cialis encouraging me to stay rock hard all night long. So you go from halfies to rock hard all night long. That's really, isn't that the true story of the male plight in life?
That is true. Although, you know, that's really just only two different stages of what should be about three or four different stages, right? You know, I mean, certainly if you're stuck at either halfy or rock hard, I mean, that's got to be somewhat of an uncomfortable life.
From what I understand, that's how Vince McMahon has led his life. You know, he's always rip-raring to go, because after all, he
is a genetic jackhammer. Well, quite frankly, that notwithstanding, we're going to take a break, ladies and gentlemen, and when we come back from the other side of the break, we're going to have what should be a rather unique installment of reading and watching, because I haven't been reading anything except this book that we talked about tonight, and there's been nothing on to watch. So we'll get to that after the break, and also the rundown. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the pro wrestling only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero here, and I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with Clotheslines and Headlines, Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows. And we leave wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse, the Our Vantage Point podcast, which features a potpourri-style look at wrestling history, and Survey Says, a fun look back at the good, bad, and ugly of WCW. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler podcast, Our Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and the Imaginary Stories. You can find all these current shows, plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All these shows, plus others, available at PlayStation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments, and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlayStation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, thehistoryofwrestling.com, and Scott Keith's blog, of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Subscribe on iTunes or on Android with your favorite podcast app. Established in 2013, the Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network is committed to providing unique takes on the rich and diverse medium of professional wrestling, focusing on its history and global impact, but also exploring the vibrant contemporary scene. The roll call includes Space City, an NWA On Demand podcast, This Week in Wrestling, Stacey and Elliott's Bogus Journey, the Super Apuestas podcast, The Military Industrial Suplex, Strong Style History, Puro Puri, and Psychology is Dead. Also, from the archives, the full catalog of great shows that provided a fresh look at classic wrestling, including Where the Big Boys Play, Titans of Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, Letters from Kayfabe, Wrestling Culture, Pro Wrestling Super Show, Goodwill Wrestling, and many, many others. Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Only the best.
Don't you ever wish you were down there?
I'm down there all I need to be.
Yes, but it's just a job to you. I'm talking about going down there and having some fun. Maybe with someone special. No. No dating for the Batman. It might cut into your brooding time.
One, dating within the team always leads to disaster. Two, you're a princess from a society of immortal warriors. I'm a rich kid with issues. Lots of issues. And three, if my enemies knew I had someone special, they wouldn't rest until they'd gotten to me through her.
Next.
There.
Saved by the bell.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the second half of the Hard Traveling Fanboys, the Longbook Hunters. You know, I don't think that we talked the entire first half of this show, Nick, about the Longbook Hunters, that being what people are listening to. I mean, the Longbook
Hunters. Yeah, the Longbook Hunters. It was an edition of the Longbook Hunters here on
the longest running.
Weekly.
Episodic.
Good Lord, Greg. You've botched the entire thing. You've ruined it, damn it.
No, I don't think that I have ruined it, because let me tell you why. Because
why?
If I had botched it, then there's no way that anyone would be able to figure out that they are listening to the longest running weekly episodic comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation.
That was a good one once we got through the botch.
That's right. Hey, botches happen. You know, you just got to be like Sabu and just don't let that change your style just because you mess something up once in a while.
Or be like Matt Hardy and The Miz earlier this week on Raw. Just stand there awkwardly until you figure out what you want to do afterwards.
Now, quite frankly, that is a somewhat attitudinal thing to bring up.
It's a somewhat accurate description of what happened. But this is a comic book podcast. We don't talk about wrestling on comic book podcast.
Wrestling is, quite frankly, what our old selves talked about.
We talk about graphic entertainment.
Although, there has been talk on the internet, and I am not, quite frankly, I'm not here to say that it's true. I'm not here to cast aspersions on these rumors. I don't know if they're true or not. What I've heard on the internet reporting websites is that there are rumors that there's a chance that there is the possibility somewhere out there that there could be a Hard Traveling Fanboys wrestling podcast. I'm not saying it's going to happen. I'm not saying it's not going to happen.
For God's sakes, Greg, that rumor has been out there for years, and all that's going to happen is, if it ever comes true, all the comic book podcast dirt sheet writers are just going to jump up and down and say they were right when they've been making the same damn prediction for over a year now. And I, quite frankly, won't stand for someone making just one prediction over and over again and then claiming victory when it's right eventually, because you've been wrong 1,000 times before. That's not going to happen on my watch.
Well, you know, I didn't want to bring this up, Nick, but there's another part to that rumor. The latest rumor I read,
yes?
and I read this on pretty good authority from some of the aforementioned dirt sheets. The rumor right now is that not only is there going to be a Hard Traveling Fanboys wrestling podcast, but that the very special guest on the first episode is going to be Tommy Merlin.
Now, quite frankly, I would remind you, who has been telling you for what, 5 years now, that Tommy Merlin was making a return? That was me, quite frankly, and I deserve 100%
of the credit. I don't know that I can give you credit for a fictional character coming into reality and joining our show.
Well, I will be the one making it happen, Greg.
That notwithstanding,
he would be my get. You know, I would be the one who would book that guest. Certainly wouldn't be you.
No, my previous attempt to get us a special guest didn't work out so well because of real life circumstances. But there's still hope for the future, ladies and gentlemen, and we'll get to that at Absolutely. A later time. But right now, it's time for your favorite segment, one of our favorite segments, the longest running segment on our aforementioned longest running weekly episodic comic book podcast on all Place B Nation. And that would be the segment known as Wonderful dulcet tones there as we set up the reading and the watching. Folks, we've reached that time of year. Preacher hasn't started back yet. The CW shows had their season finales last week, which you can hear all about on our special edition podcast where we reviewed each and every one of the CW season finales last week. So they're off the air right now. I have not yet delved into Luke Cage, much less Iron Fist yet, although that should be around the bend pretty soon. Nick, are you watching anything comic book related at the moment?
No, I am not. Just been playing The Injustice 2, and yeah, that's pretty much it. Just waiting on Preacher to come back. I think at some point during this little, it's about a month long break between comic book shows, I might try to squeeze in Legion in there. I've thought about potentially trying to watch some Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. or some, you know, something else that I've missed. But at the moment, I have nothing to report.
And you're not talking about the never mind. That was Observe and Report. I'm sorry. The mall cop movie that didn't star Kevin James.
No, it starred Seth Rogen. It was a very dark comedy, honestly.
With all that being, I mean, I guess we could talk briefly about Injustice. You've played through it, Nick. I will have no ability to play it probably for quite some time.
Tell you what, why don't we talk about Injustice on next week's show when you've had an opportunity to play it?
I will play it this weekend, apparently. When we're going to go see and watch Wonder Woman, which we'll have thoughts on next week. So that'll be fun. I have been playing the Injustice mobile game, which is very, 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 very difficult, but fun. And I continue to play DC Legends. And I've been playing Marvel's Contest of Champions as well, which is pretty fun. So,
man, you're just mobile gamed out at the moment.
Yeah, that's a very good point. But nevertheless, that's playing, and we're not here to talk about playing yet. We're done with watching. We got nothing. Let's move on to reading. And as I mentioned earlier, I got nothing. So, Nick.
Oh, here we go. Carrying your sorry ass once again. Well, I'm going to kick it off because it's my segment, essentially, and I can kick it off in whatever order I damn well please. I'm going to go with my bottom book of the week first. And for my bottom book of the week, I went with Deathstroke number 19. This is part 3 of the Lazarus Contract crossover between Titans, Teen Titans, and Deathstroke. A fine issue, nothing really bad about it. The art largely just didn't work for me, and I felt like it was probably the weakest chapter of the Lazarus Contract story thus far. Kind of gives away the reveal of what this issue is about fairly early on, and doesn't really do much more to explore the concept other than just kind of give it to you on its face. Essentially, it's what if Deathstroke had speedster powers, and it doesn't really do anything overly innovative or interesting with that throughout the book. So that being said, it does set the stage for a very intriguing conclusion, which comes out this week. So I will be sure to give my thoughts on the finale of the Lazarus Contract on next week's show. But yeah, Deathstroke number 19, yeah, that's my bottom book of the week. And then moving on to my top three. At number 3, I have Batman Detective Comics 957, and this is a story entitled The Wrath of Spoiler. And what this kind of does is it picks up the pieces of the Stephanie Brown story that were left dangling in the wake of the Victim Syndicate storyline. And it kind of has Stephanie explaining to the reader what her new goal is, why she is still wearing a costume, but how she is working through the hypocrisy that Greg called her out for. She mentions it up front. She's like, yeah, I know I'm wearing one of these things, but as you'll see, my goals and aims are a little bit different than Batman. And the ultimate reveal is that she is working in the shadows. There's a hostage situation at a Gotham television station that she infiltrates and takes down the organization that took people hostage. But before anybody else can arrive on the scene, she slips out the door, and the only person she communicates with on the way out is Harvey Bullock. And she says, when you write this up, you get the credit, the police, not me. I don't want people to know I was here. And so it seems like her entire goal is going to be to get Gotham to reinstate its faith in the Gotham police force and perhaps have people seek to become more accustomed and more comfortable with the more traditional way of doing things, almost trying to phase Batman out in a very passive-aggressive way, it seems like. So I dug this issue.
To kind of do away with the mythology of Batman and the inspiration that he caused,
right,
through Zero Year.
And through her eyes, that will keep her from pulling people into his crazy crusade and getting people hurt, because she is still very much driven by the death of Tim Drake. So I dug this one. It kind of, you know, gave Stephanie some much needed character exploration and explanation after Victim Syndicate. So dug this one, and Detective Comics continues to be on a pretty massive roll. Moving on to my number two book of the week, I've got Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps, number 21. I really don't want to say much about this one because it has a reveal in it of who this villain actually is that has come from the future and what his parentage is. And it's one that I saw coming about halfway through the book, but it still hit me in a big, big way with the emotional reveal of who is most impacted by the idea they've had to take down this villain. That's all I really want to say. Robert Venditti continues to nail it on this one. I can't wait for you to catch up on this, Greg, so we can talk more about this Prism of Time storyline. And then finally, at my number one book of the week, and I don't think this was any surprise for those of you who knew what was coming out this past week and who have listened to the podcast over the past year, but my number one book of the week is Wonder Woman 23. This is the finale of the Truth storyline from Greg Rucka and Liam Sharp. This brings home the truth behind how Themyscira works in the DC universe, why Diana is not allowed to return there now that she has left, and Diana is forced to ultimately choose whether she will return home once and for all or have it be essentially forever lost to her. And the choice she makes ultimately is very, very heartbreaking, and it really redefines her relationship with one of her major villains throughout the course of this issue, to the point where if you're talking about the top Wonder Woman villains, I think there are two that spring to mind immediately, and Greg Rucka was essentially able to redefine both of them in the course of 23 issues, which is just an amazing, amazing job by him. I'm very sad to see the Truth storyline end. Luckily, we got a little bit more of that Rucka and Sharp pairing coming up at number 25, but this just put a perfect bow on the epic they've been building for the last year. And then finally,
tell the truth.
And then finally, the only quick hit I have is Action Comics 980, a very good issue of Action Comics. One of my favorites in recent memory, kind of fleshes out the idea behind the Superman Revenge Squad and sets them off on a mission to go and find their final member who is essential to their plot being successful. And if they wind up getting this guy, it'll be a virtual who's who of Superman villains. It's a pretty cool concept, even if the name of the Superman Revenge Squad is a bit hokey for my taste. Yep, Hank Henshaw back and leading the Superman Revenge Squad.
Ladies and gentlemen, such an honor it is for me to be here. This is, of course, the legendary French actor Gérard Depardieu, and I'm here to say this brings an end to the reading and the watching segment of the program. And now it's time for all the news and notes from the comic book world. That's right. This is a segment of the program we call
Welcome to the Rundown, where we talk some comic news. Welcome to the
That's right. It's the rundown and slowdown news-wise in the comic book industry. But we do have something about, not the least of which, is an image, that accompanies a story that we're talking about here. A story that I would encourage you on your internet device to look up on newsarama.com. Their story is report, colon, Black Tom Cassidy.
Colon.
Black Tom Cassidy cast for Deadpool 2. And when you open this story, I think you'll be happy with what you see, because what you see is an image. An image of woo, an image of Deadpool straddling a gasoline pump, squirting it
and placing it so that the nozzle is pointing as if it's coming out of his asshole.
Holding a lighter above it and farting in the direction of Black Tom Cassidy, creating a massive fireball effect.
and the look on Black Tom Cassidy's face is really what sells it.
I don't know. Oh. I don't know who drew this image. I don't know from what comic it comes, but I do know that I want to buy this comic book and read it.
Oh, God.
Oh, that's really all we wanted to talk about was the image. But the actual story is that someone from the show The Strain, named Jack Kessie, who I don't know who that is, has been cast as Black Tom Cassidy to be in the Deadpool sequel. Deadpool, if you will. Now, Black Cassidy is described as a, quote, major villain for the film. However, Josh Brolin's Cable is the principal villain, according to Deadline. That's interesting. Cable is the villain. Curious.
I'm sure there'll be some sort of third act twist where they find a mutual common ground.
I'm betting that Cable is going to be traveling through time and has to kill Deadpool because of some effect that Deadpool has on the timeline. That'll probably have something to do with it, but we'll see how that plays out. But yeah, for those that don't,
and wouldn't it be in true Deadpool like fashion if like ultimately they put their differences aside when they discover that their mothers had the same middle name or some other indirect shot of the DCEU?
I almost think they have to do that, don't you? I almost think that has to be a gag.
They kind of have to. If they don't, it's kind of a missed opportunity. I mean, it's a layup, like. It's an obvious joke, but one that would probably play huge to the Deadpool Mildred? Audience.
Your mother's name is Mildred, too? No, just her middle name. All right, best friends.
Close enough. Did we just become best friends?
Oh, man, this is great. So Black Tom Cassidy, the deal with him, he's a longtime X-Men villain. Todd and Tim can get into much more details about him because he plays... It plays a role in the Claremont and Byrne years. But basically, from what I remember as a child, Black Tom Cassidy has some sort of ability to, like, turn his hands into wood or something. And also, he has the mutant ability of being Juggernaut's friend. So, that's that. Maybe we'll get a Juggernaut appearance in Deadpool. That would be neat. Nevertheless...
Will it be Vinnie Jones Juggernaut?
You know, I didn't have a problem with Vinnie Jones playing the Juggernaut. I just really hated that take on the Juggernaut, if that makes sense.
The way they chose to illustrate the Juggernaut, where he was just a normal sized dude, was what I hated.
Yes.
Vinnie Jones himself would have been fine. And even I would say the portrayal, like the actual acting, was okay. It's just the way the character was conceived was altogether.
Mm-hmm.
It's terrible, I would say.
They should have just They should have gone into the future and got the Juggernaut Roman Reigns to play him. That would have been good. Speaking of the Fox movie division, we also got a bunch of interviews this week from the director Josh Boone, who is going to be directing Fox's New Mutants movie, talking about what the movie's going to be, who's going to be in it, etc. And he said, dropped some pretty interesting interesting interviews here, because he revealed that the movie is going to have a horror tone. It's going to be closer to a horror movie than a superhero movie. And along those lines, he indicated that we won't be seeing traditional superhero costumes or traditional comic book supervillains. That instead, we're going to be seeing a full-fledged horror movie set within the X-Men universe. No costumes, no supervillains. It's going to be, quote, very, very different. Some of the original New Mutants comics did include horror elements, such as the Demon Bear saga. We've had Maisie Williams cast as Wolfsbane and Anya Taylor-Joy as Magic. So Magic is certainly a bit of a supernatural take. And it's going to be heavily influenced by the work of Bill Sienkiewicz, who was the great comic book artist on New Mutants back in the 80s and has such a distinctive style. I know he's a very favorite of Todd in particular, who's a huge fan of his. Interesting notes here about the film. Also that Rosario Dawson may be about to join New Mutants as Cecilia Reyes, a mutant doctor with a protective force field who was once a member of the X-Men. So that's going to be interesting if she'll be in both the Fox Marvel Universe and the Marvel Cinematic Universe via Netflix. There's also a report that the actor Henry Zaga has been cast as Sunspot, one of the always one of the mutant characters that had the coolest powers to me. I really love his like solar burst powers, and his look and everything were always really cool. Nick, what do you make about this New Mutants project thus far?
You know, it's one that was kind of off my radar, mainly because from everything we had heard, we had not been led to believe that it was going to be connected to the young group of mutants introduced in Logan. And so I kind of just didn't really have much of an interest, didn't really have much of a knowledge of what it's going to be. I will say that while the comments Josh Boone have made are somewhat controversial, at least it sounds like they're trying to do something different and unique again, which kind of what has set the X-Men franchise at Fox apart from other superhero franchises in recent years. So I'll say it sounds at least like he's got a clear, distinct vision, and it sounds like something that could either be different and you're just in a wildly successful way, or perhaps fall flat on its face. But I will say I'm at least much more intrigued by this project now than I was previously.
Hey, I agree completely. You know, I initially reacted kind of harshly to the thought of not having superhero costumes in the movie, because that kind of makes, you know, that kind of makes me think about how things were back in the day, before superheroes were more mainstream. But the more that I think about it, like you said, different. And that's what I think has been so great about the Fox movies in recent years, is they've proven that beyond Marvel and DC, they're willing to take chances, bold chances with their movies, and do things and create movies that genuinely feel different from one another. You know, X-Men Days of Future Past feels much different from Deadpool, which feels much different from Logan. So, hey, you know what? I'm willing to give them a chance on this, benefit of the doubt, to come up with something that's distinctive and unique in the genre.
In the genre, yeah. I mean, and if they're leaning heavily into the horror elements, and it's going to be a story about kids on the run from this potentially the demon bear or whatever this demonic force is, it kind of makes sense that you wouldn't really have time to stop and suit up, so to speak. So, the costumes thing doesn't necessarily bother me, although I do think the no supervillains quote, if they do wind up doing demon bear, is a bit disingenuous, because most people would classify, from what I understand anyway, would classify Demon Bear as one of the main villains for the New Mutants. So it's a little bit of semantics there with the supervillains thing. But, you know, ultimately, as long as it's different and unique, I can't really complain too much.
And speaking of horror elements, we've got a big Marvel crossover event that's just been announced. And it is called Venomverse. It is a take on the idea of Spider-Verse, which was a crossover event from a few years ago that I know very little to nothing about.
It featured all the different Spider characters from throughout the Marvel multiverse coming together for one to unite against a common threat. Our old friend Morlun from back during the Other was seeking to go throughout the multiverse and consume all the Spider characters, and so they banded together to fight Morlun.
Presumably to kill the spiders, but leave the man.
Exactly.
Well, this is the same thing pretty much, but with Venom.
Yes.
And
all the different versions of the symbiote from throughout the Marvel multiverse coming together.
Coming together, focusing very much on the horror aspects. It's been described by the author, the writer, as if Spider-Verse was Saving Private Ryan, this is Die Hard. And I don't really know what that means, but that is what has been said. Cullen Bunn is crafting it and gets started, I believe. Am I correct, Nick, that this starts June 28th in Edge of Venomverse number one? I am correct because I just read it. And then Venomverse number one starts September 6th. You know, I'm not a regular Marvel reader these days. Is this something that interests you?
Probably not. Although I do like Cullen Bunn's writing, and I am at least intrigued by the new Venom series, which apparently is going to be the first one to officially embrace the Marvel legacy approach, the renumbering, the sort of back to basics approach to Venom by bringing Eddie Brock back. But this wild, crazy thing featuring all the Venoms from throughout the Marvel multiverse, probably not up my alley, honestly.
I would agree with that. We've only got one more item left, ladies and gentlemen. Finally, last but not least, we've got a story about a show that we follow pretty closely, Supergirl on the CW. Word came out this week that Floriana Lima, who plays Maggie Sawyer on the show, will not be returning Supergirl next year as a series regular so that she can pursue other opportunities. Now, this is seemingly a big deal because the Supergirl season finale featured a big plot point where Alex proposed to Maggie, who seemingly said yes, although we didn't actually see her say yes, after a season-long love story between those two characters. However, this article does state that she will appear in more than one episode of Season 3 to wrap up the romantic relationship with Alex Danvers. So, but still, that term wrap up the romantic relationship, that's kind of bittersweet, isn't it?
Yeah, I have a little bit of fantasy booking. Would you like to hear it?
I have a feeling that I might.
Well, let me tell you a little bit about my fantasy booking idea. So I would actually pick up Season 3 by having Maggie accept Alex's proposal, and then over the first, like, let's say for the purposes of this discussion, they have 4 or 5 episodes of her being committed to this series for 4 or 5 episodes. Do the wedding build for 4 or 5 episodes, get ready for the wedding, and as they're preparing to get married, some sort of supervillain threat comes in. Supergirl comes in to save the day, but fails and is unable to save Maggie Sawyer's life, and Maggie dies in Alex's arms on their wedding day or close to their wedding day or something like that. And then hearing about the death of Maggie Sawyer, hearing about Supergirl's inability to save her life, that's where you bring in Kate Kane, you bring in Batwoman, and you have the female version of that classic Batman versus Superman conflict where for a time period, Supergirl and Batwoman will be very much at odds. And this could provide you with that first half of the season conflict before they transition into the villain reign that was teased. That'll probably be the main focus of season 3.
I love it. I love it. I think that's great. There is no reason there should be an embargo on the Batwoman character, if there are embargoes anymore. That's a great idea, Nick. Why not introduce Kate Kane to the masses? Give her her first real mainstream exposure. I like it.
And if you're going to have them in conflict, that would be – I mean, that story point is something that we could all empathize with rather than, it just seeming arbitrary, any reason for them disagreeing or fighting each other.
Yep. Now, will you keep the mother angle?
The mother angle?
Where they resolve their conflict through the names of their mothers.
Oh, sorry. I apologize. I didn't pick up on that. Well, that doesn't really make sense. Well, I don't know, Greg. I can't really. I don't know. No. No, damn it. Let me answer.
For God's sake, no. You know, that's how Watts used to propose all of his angles to end in Mid-South Wrestling.
They had the same mother's name.
God damn it, Cactus. I never knew your mama's name was the same as mine. Why didn't
oh, that's
you
awesome.
Say so?
That's good. Oh,
a little funker good. There. That's the end of the rundown, ladies and gentlemen. Sad to see Maggie go, obviously. You know, all good things must come to an end, and I like that idea from Nick there. Hopefully they'll do something similar. With that being said, end of the rundown. We hope you've enjoyed this week's show. What do we have coming the folks' way in the very near future, Nick?
Well, as we mentioned, this is Wonder Woman month, so coming up on next week's show, we're going to have a very special edition of the podcast in which we bring to you a full-length review of Wonder Woman's solo big screen debut. That's right, Greg and I, along with Russell Sellers and various other individuals that may or may not be featured here on Place to Be Nation Pop. We'll be seeing the film together this weekend, and we will be bringing you our exclusive thoughts right here on these very airwaves next week. In 2 weeks' time, we will be taking you off the page with a very special look at the failed NBC pilot for a Wonder Woman television series that was to be produced by David E. Kelley of Ally McBeal fame. And finally, to wrap up Wonder Woman Month, we will be bringing you an edition of Countdown in which we count down our top five single issues of the Greg Rucka Wonder Woman Rebirth run. And then that will bring an end to Wonder Woman month. But because we have 5 weeks in June, we will be wrapping up the month of June with a giant size edition. We mentioned it earlier as we bring you the most prestigious event in all of Place to Be Nation Pop. That's right, the 2017 Haffy Awards live from Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada.
Star-studded. Everyone will be there. We're talking Dom DeLuise.
Yep.
We're talking Burt Reynolds. We're talking Burt Bacharach. We're talking Burt Ward. We're talking about the Burt that played Paulie in the Rocky movies. Every Burt in Hollywood is going to be there.
And for what I mean, it is such a formal occasion, Greg. I know everybody's going to be dressed to the nines, dressed in their best. You know, and sometimes when that happens, you get a little stray thread that may run. Just a little advice for everyone: if you find yourself in that situation, just be sure to bring a pair of scissors with you. That way, you can snip those off if need be.
Well, I've always said, Nick, that if I needed to confront someone in a street fight, the move from wrestling that I've learned that I think would help me the most would certainly be Booker T's scissors kick.
Scissors kick. Yeah, that's a good idea. I like it.
So we've got all of that coming your way and much, much more in the very near future. Hope you've enjoyed the show. Again, give us your feedback. Let us know what we can do better. Let us know what we can do worse if you want us to suck a little bit more than we do. Hopefully the audio quality is better than it's been in recent weeks. We're trying some new things to shake things up.
Kind of an experiment here today. Yeah.
That's right. This is a very experimental broadcast that you're listening to right now. And hopefully, if all goes well, we'll come back to this next week. If not, we'll try something else. So with that being said, I am Greg Phillips. He is the modern-day Maharaja, Nick Duke. And we are the Hard Traveling Fanboys. Don't you dare miss next week's episode.